the Gapstone style, won the Forward Poetry Prize for Best First Collection and was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Her second collection, Dart, won the T.S. Eliot Prize in 2002. In 2004, Alice Oswald was named one of the Poetry Book Society's Next Generation Poets. And her next collection, Woods, etc., was shortlisted for the Forward Prize and the T.S. Eliot Prize. And it won the Geoffrey Faber Memorial Prize. In 2007, her poem, Dunt, won the Forward Poetry Prize for Best Single Poem. Weeds and Wild Flowers, illustrated by Jessica Greenman, was shortlisted for the 2009 T.S. Eliot Prize and won the inaugural Ted Hughes Award for New Work in Poetry. A Sleepwalk on the Severn, a poem in several voices, was published in 2009, and her latest collection, Memorial, was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Jane Wheatley in The Times talks about Dart, her second collection of poems, and she says, "If you never read poetry, make an exception for this." Ladies and gentlemen, Alice Oswald. Yeah, so first I'd just like to ask you, as we always do, just about your selection of poems. So firstly, the Gerald Manley Hopkins.
Yeah, it's really hard to be asked to think of two poems, because obviously one wants to think of 200. But Hopkins is very important to me because I feel as if he taught me everything I know about rhythm. When I was working as a gardener, just after I'd left university, I used rather indulgently to come home and read Hopkins aloud to myself. And it was really different reading it out loud. I'd always read him in books, but when I started reading him out loud, I just got very excited by how physical it felt and by the fact that I needed to, in some way, make some physical gesture of sort of syncopation when I read him. And that those little kind of half beats that you get in Hopkins are what I love. They're kind of what I love about poetry. Anything that isn't actually contained in the words, but is somehow a little sort of silence or hesitation or cough or something between the words. But also, that particular poem, Patience, is sort of my God, I suppose. Patience, I'm a very impatient person, and I sort of try and balance myself by using patience sort of symbolically. All day. That's kind of what I strive for, being a very restless, impatient person. And I think it's just brilliant the way that poem, it has a very restless, breathless rhythm. It's a sonnet, and yet it's kind of a really choppy sonnet. And I love the way it's about patience, and yet it's an incredibly impatient poem until that last little bit at the end. Yeah, so that's Hopkins. Ian Hamilton Finley was a kind of strange choice. It's slightly unfair to allow you only to read one line. But I was very influenced by him. When I was working as a gardener, which I did for about 7 years, I went and had an interview with Ian Hamilton Finley trying to be his gardener. And in fact, that was the beginning of a long correspondence with him. He started out as a short story writer, then he was a concrete poet in the 60s, and then he kind of moved his poems onto objects, specifically into gardens, and became a kind of garden poet. And he just had an incredibly interesting approach to language. I suppose what I really learnt of him was a way of seeing language as fragmentary. Everything he was really interested in language as a fragment, and that it had to be completed by its context, its landscape, a garden or a sculpture or whatever. So in the same way that in Hopkins I like whatever happens between the words, in Hamilton Finley I like the kind of space that surrounds his language. It's always incredibly concise. Sometimes it's one word, sometimes it's one phrase. And it draws attention to the kind of space around itself in a very beautiful way, I think.
I wondered whether it had influenced your own writing. Sometimes you do sort of concrete things in your own. You leave a gap in Dart, for instance, for silence. Was that, do you think, influenced by?
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, even when I'm not making it obvious by concretely leaving a gap, I've always wanted each phrase to be, as it were, you could isolate it and put it on a stone and it would feel okay. So my kind of test as I write is, you know, would that just be nothing if you engraved that on a stone, or would that have a kind of solidity? Would it be enough? And would it also draw attention to the space around it? I think I'm very influenced by it.
And have you visited Little Sparta? Because that's his famous garden.
It's wonderfully crazy.
I've never been, but
it's just so crowded with language. It's an amazing place.
Great, thank you. So I want to start, as always, in this interview by just asking you a little bit about your life, just to help people get a sense of you. So firstly, I thought you might just say about something about your background, where you come from, as it were, the sort of world you were brought up into, your parents. I know your mother is a garden designer and writer, Mary Keane, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, we're already talking about gardens and your gardening and so on, and later on we'll talk about weeds and wildflowers, but let's talk a bit about that.
Yes, I was always, we moved house quite a lot, but I was always really brought up in a garden. So when people ask me where I'm from, I don't really feel I'm from anywhere. I was always kind of walled into these rather beautiful gardens with the feeling of a real world somewhere beyond. And I love gardens, but I'm also slightly claustrophobic in them. So that was very important to me. And we seemed to move house all the time. I only ever went to schools for about 2 years at a time, really, until secondary school. Then I managed about 4 years, I think.
Why did you move so much?
My father worked in a bank, and they used to move him up and down the country.
And what about writing? When did writing enter your life? I read a review of one of your interviews, and you said, I think, in the interview that you realised at 8 years old you wanted to commit yourself to poetry, and that before then you'd thought you'd be a policeman.
Yes.
What's happened to being put in?
That's still a small possibility.
Poetry doesn't work.
I made a very definite decision. It was really through being terrified at night, and one night staying awake for a whole night. And it's really strange when you're a child suddenly to see the whole of a night. It's such a different world from daylight. And there was such relief when I realised the dawn was coming up. And I just had definite realisation that actually nothing I said was going to communicate that moment. It had to be said in a very different way. And poetry was the way that seemed right to describe that absolutely different kind of experience. And I think I've always had that feeling that poetry can describe something that a daylight language can't really describe. And I was quite stubborn, so then I stuck with that decision.
What interested me is the language of commitment, because, you know, other people might have said, I felt very enthusiastic about it, or I was very suddenly interested in it. But what do you think made it commitment, which is a strong word, isn't it, in a way?
No, it really was a kind of vow I made to myself, and I had a very kind of, I reckoned I needed to pay for it, you know, it was something. I had a great kind of horrible Puritan streak in me that made me very definite about the idea that I had to, you know, had to not watch television, or I had to stick feathers in the ground, or even it became quite, I would have things like in the middle of the night and have to get up and do something that I'd be terrified by in order to, you know, just make this little payment that the goddess of poetry required. So it was a very, very much a kind of commitment and a decision.
And were you reading poems at that time? Did that sort of influence that?
I did read whatever I could sort of. Your library's very limited as a child, which like, actually. I'm a great believer in not having too much choice. And I had a tiny little thing of Shakespeare's sonnets, and I had book called Oh What Nonsense, which had nonsense poems, and I had my mother was very good at giving me small books that you could slip into. I didn't like physics at school, and we had these huge physics textbooks. She used to get me these little poem books that would actually slip into the physics book, which is, I did fail my physics level because of that. Whatever, you know, children just read what they can find.
And you were reading Shakespeare's sonnets then, were you?
I probably wasn't understanding them, but I just quite liked that that probably wasn't eight, actually, that was... maybe... I just remember I was given in my stocking one Christmas just this little, lovely little paperback, and I always love little things.
So I
would just read them. Yeah.
I think I was... I don't remember, that's not good about me, but I don't think I was reading them at that time. Later on you say that as a teenager you talk about feeling overwhelmed by the freshness of Homer, reading Homer for the first time. Obviously we're going to come back to Homer with Memorial, but I wonder whether you could say something about the moment of reading Homer, the moment of that kind of being overwhelmed by it. Very striking.
Yeah, well, I suppose I was quite a sort of... I was very keen on reading and loved reading poems. And then I was very struck when I started reading Homer at school that it just seemed incredibly different. It didn't seem like literature. It seemed just more like the world. It had this extraordinary sort of actuality to it. It felt very sort of solid and breathed and physical. And so I always had the feeling that Homer wasn't really literature at all. It wasn't poetry. It was something very different. It was like an actual different world that you could go and visit. And so I became incredibly interested in how something that's made of language can yet sort of signify objects in such a different way. It seemed as if it was actually literally magic what Homer did, whereas the poets that I was used to seemed to describe the world, but not to actually make a world like that. That really interested me.
And how did you come upon Homer?
Well, I was studying Greek at school, and then I was lucky enough to be the only person studying it, so I was...
I can imagine, actually.
which was a real treat, because that meant I could just concentrate on Homer, which is what I love.
Of course. And you went on to study classics at Oxford. I wonder whether you could talk a bit about the influence of classical writing generally on your work. You've talked about it in various places, but it does seem to be quite a big influence in your writing.
I mean, I always kind of say to myself that I'm much more influenced by the sort of archaic, well, by Homer, really, rather than when it gets to be too... later classics, I'm always a bit kind of nervous about its sort of regulations. There's something very wild about Homer, and it becomes much, much stricter later on. But actually, I think I mean, I love the pluralism of the classics. I love the fact that they've got lots of gods. I feel I've got lots of gods, and that's something that appeals to me. I love the stillness that you get in the classics, I think. I think that's something I got through Ian Hamilton Finley as well. He has this love of definitions, dictionaries, and a way of making a stillness out of language. And I think the classics will, you know, it's very, you get a lot of that in Greek in particular. It's very hard to define. I suppose it's like Plato's Forms. There's just a kind of sense, a sort of availability of stillness in the classics that maybe you don't get later on. But also, above all, just that freshness. There is a real... You can really smell what they're writing about. It's lovely. But I'm also aware that it's... You know, it can be used... There is a sort of fear that people get when you start talking about the classics, because people think, oh, I don't know what that's about. And I don't like that aspect of it. And one of the things I wanted to do with Homer was to sort of liberate it from that kind of over-educated approach to it.
Yeah, people can quite be nervous. I mean, like, for instance, you know, it's in the past, but it's been a sort of assumed that poets would know Latin and Greek, and that was your basic education if you were going to write any poetry. is that true?
it perhaps was in the past. It doesn't need to be. And I think it had perhaps got a bit... it had become quite snobbish. It's quite nice to go back and discover something different in the classics, I think. You know, they've become quite sort of stultified, really, by the sort of insistence that they're difficult and noble and all that sort of thing.
Sort of taking it out into the library rather than...
Yeah.
And you kept moving on. You then became a gardener, as you said. And then you've got this wonderful book, Weeds and Wildflowers, with Jessica Greenman. Can you say something about your love of nature? You've been quite careful at times to say, I'm not a nature poet. So we were just chatting about that earlier. Nature is nevertheless a sort of touchstone for your work. Can you say something about being a gardener and then how that's affected? Because you did it for quite a while, didn't it? 7 years.
Yeah, I did it for about 7 years, and it was very lovely. The feeling of my brain changing when I became a gardener, because I'd been in quite an academic world for quite a long time, and it was really surprising how my mind, how things kind of brightened up when I started doing physical work. And it was as if literally my mind was an egg timer and I was just tipping it the other way up. And I just became aware of the kind of intelligence of the hands and the way the senses get quite dulled if you're always using your thinking mind. And I found that incredibly exciting. Just the sort of energy you get off really being with things, particularly being with things that aren't human. Something, I suppose why I'm wary of the title nature poet is that people just presume it's about kind of nostalgia and some kind of idyll that's past. And for me, being a gardener, I just became aware that there's something, it feels like the most contemporary thing you can do to be actually outside it. Working with living things rather than a kind of man-made environment. You know, it's all about light. That's the main thing you're aware of when you're gardening. You're mostly looking down, and all day long you're just seeing the incredibly rapid changes of light on the ground. You cannot say that light is nostalgic. It only takes 8 minutes to get from the sun to the earth. So.
And just sort of key point, just the last thing I wanted to sort of say about your, you know, what I've learned about your life is, you know, children, you've got three children, and rereading Weeds and Wildflowers, I was struck by a very strong child's voice, probably particularly in that collection.
Yeah, I mean, children are, I mean, I love children's minds. They're almost, my kind of fascination with Homer sort of almost transferred onto a fascination with an uneducated, a sort of child's mind before the schools have got them. And I steal a lot from my children, their sort of fresh way of looking at the world. But perhaps also in Weeds and Wildflowers, when I was writing it, I was mostly, we spent a couple of years, we moved back to live with my parents for a bit. And so I think I was feeling like a child myself at that stage. So, yeah, there's possibly quite a lot of me as a child.
So let's move on to the books. And what I want to do, if I can, is just sort of talk about four of the collections, four of the six collections. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about is this interest you have for book-length books, for themed books. So of your six collections, four of them are either a themed book or a book-length collection. It seems very striking about your work when you first meet it, how much of it is like that. And I just wonder whether you could say something about what draws you to that. Even in reading Memorial, I wonder whether there was an epic sense somewhere in the background, in your mind.
In a way, though, I'm always writing short poems while I'm writing long poems, but they take me longer. I find I can write long poems quite quickly. And so I've probably got another collection of short poems that I haven't published. So they are, I suppose I always like to work, I'm a very contradictory person, I like to do two opposite things at the same time always. And I like the different qualities that a long poem brings out, and to sort of weigh that against what a short poem requires. But there is definitely a feeling that when you get into a long poem, it's sort of got its own centre of gravity, and it will quite speedily sort of open up and offer you more and more that will kind of swoop into it. Whereas there's a sense with short poems that at the end of each poem you go into this kind of abyss, and there's nothing there, and I hate that feeling. And I think that's partly just technically to do with the fact that there's so much choice when you're writing contemporary poetry. You're not bound to a particular form or a particular subject. So unless you put a framework of a long poem around, or a theme around your poems, there's just this kind of infinite choice with each poem. And so it takes me quite a long time to sort of really generate the necessity for a short poem. Whereas long poems, they have their own necessity kind of embedded in them.
And do you sort of find out how long they want to be, as it were, when you write them?
Yes, I generally sort of, at the beginning, I presume they're going to take me a lifetime to write and that they'll be as long as several telephone directories. But then there's a point, I suppose because I love the fragment, there's a point where it becomes clear that I can break off. And I always feel they're part of something bigger, but that, that's just,
In the sense that they go beyond the edges, a bit like
painting.
So let's look at them in turn. So firstly, you know, your remarkable poem, Dart. Rereading it, I was struck again by its incredible freshness, and I was thinking muscularity about it. It's a book-length poem following the River Dart from its source to the sea, and seamlessly moving between prose and rhyming couplets and lyrics and many different voices. I'm aware it took about 2 years to research, so I've read. Could you say something about how it came into being? I mean, it's a very unusual poem in a way. When you first meet it, having read other contemporary poems, it's a very unusual poem in many ways, I think.
Yeah, I think it partly arose from suddenly having children and not being able to garden anymore. And I was really lacking that kind of that contact with sort of workaday life. And I was living by the Dart in Devon, which is an incredibly beautiful river, and I was desperately wanting to write about it because it was sort of where I was spending all my time and walking and things. But I was really wary of approaching it too aesthetically, and I really wanted to find out about the sort of practical aspects of the river, how it felt, you know, to people who work with it or live by it every day or boat on it. Because my experience with gardening had taught me that it's no good writing about a tree or a plant unless you've actually worked with them, because you get such a multi-dimensional view of them when you work with them. So I wanted to steal other people's understanding of the river and to make a poem that was, again, this was sort of because of my love of Homer. And Homer is supposedly an oral poet who is not just one person, it's a whole kind of collection of voices stitched together. And I wanted to make an equivalent poem that would be by lots of people rather than just by myself. So I recorded interviews with people who work on the river and used their language specifically for the poem. And yeah, it sort of filled in that gap that had been left by having to stop gardening, I suppose.
And you say somewhere that you didn't think it was a poet's poem. I wondered what you...
Well, yeah, I think a lot of poets were made quite angry by it because it didn't really fit any form, because it kind of, rather like a river, it just moves all the time in and out of forms. And it uses quite a lot of prose, and it's an incredibly baggy, loose poem. So, yeah, some people kind of like that and some people don't.
You were saying it broke so many rules.
It broke all my rules for a start, yes. I mean, up to that point, I'd just been incredibly strict about, well, first of all, I would only ever write sonnets, and then when I kind of broke out of sonnets, I had to have something that was just as tight rhythmically. And when I started to write, and also from a very singular point of view, and with Dart, suddenly I was taking on a multiple point of view and all sorts of different sounds. And really allowing prose to invade poetry, I suppose. That was
a lot of sort of prose that you wouldn't expect, working prose, as it were. It's interesting, going back to what you were saying about working in a garden. And there is a strong working feeling, physical feeling to it, isn't there, in many ways?
Yeah, well, I think, I just had developed quite an impatience with a sort of intellectual or poetic voice, because I just felt if you're going to, especially if you're going to write about the natural world, you need to take on the voice of people who know it in all its dimensions.
And do you think, what made me wonder about someone like Frost, who was trying to write both for a sort of in a way, critical poetry audience, but also trying to, quite clearly, trying to write for every reader, for any reader. And I have a sense of that with all of your writing, that you're a bit like Frost in that way, trying to do both, trying to talk to any reader who would pick up a book and try to talk to someone who, you know, knows poetry very well. I don't know whether that's own ambition.
Yeah, no, that is very important to me. I mean, because poetry is incredibly necessary for my life, I would hate to think that in some way I was writing something that was inaccessible to anyone who wanted to read it. But I also think that it's worth putting in the hard work that one does put into a poem, because there will also be readers who will have read lots of poetry and will get more out of it for that. So, I think one tries to write on several levels, with the hope that if you can be understandable by people, then they'll be prepared to put in the effort to sort of, you know, go deeper and deeper into a poem. Mm. I do kind of worry about poetry putting itself into a sort of place where... I don't mean ordinary people, because nobody's ordinary, but people who aren't necessarily used to reading poetry, where they can't reach it.
And there's lots of people feel that contemporary poetry is really written for contemporary poets, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, as you were talking before about the imagination and the potential, that is something that's in everybody, and that everybody needs. And I think poetry is the best possible food or exercise for the imagination.
So let's move on to Sleepwalk on the Severn. If Dart is a, you know, as you say, a songline of a river from the source of the sea, Sleepwalk on the Severn is a unsettling paean to the moon. And one of the things that I must say, striking rereading it, is, you know, if you imagine how many people have written about the moon, it's such a difficult thing to write about, I think, about the moon, because everybody's talked about it from Homer onwards. So to be able to write about the moon, in the way that the moon appears, which I think you actually managed to do rather miraculously in Sleepwalk on the Severn, is really, really quite something. Anyway, that's just an aside. But again, it's based on real people in the Severn catchment, some living, some dead. Again, can you say something about how you came to write it?
Yeah, I suppose after I'd written Dart, I kept being asked to do the same thing, and I don't like doing the same thing twice. So I was asked to write something about the Severn, and I thought that I would focus... I'd very much in Dart had focused on its kind of space, on its kind of map quality, and on the Severn I wanted to focus on time, and I was particularly interested in its incredible tidal range and the way it is... it's just an image of the moon, really, that the way it moves in and out up the estuary. So I sort of explored the river via the moon, and although I talked to fewer people than I did with Dart, and I was much less careful about... I didn't take a tape recorder, and I allowed the imagination to record them rather than in a sort of documentary way. So I kind of allowed a process of forgetting, so that they're much more... sort of invented, although they're based on conversations that I had. And I was really doing something quite different in that poem. I'm really pleased you said the thing about the moon appearing, because I saw the poem as a kind of pinhole. I wanted to actually let the verse feel the effect of moonlight. There's a wonderful line in Beckett when he was directing his own version of Waiting for Godot, and he said to one of the actors, "Could you speak that line again, this time with moonlight in your voice?" And I just really, I was so interested in that. You know, what is language when it's got moonlight in it? So that poem was all just thinking about how you can... This is my whole thing that I've always been interested in, is rather than describing something with language, how do you somehow let the actual object in through the language? And that's what that poem was trying to do. And I used kind of prose and dialogue, and then I moved into poetry when the moon rose. So every time the moon rises, the language breaks into poetry. And I saw it in a similar way to... I was reading a lot of Japanese no plays, where they seem to have that, just exactly that structure, that they'll have people talking, and then suddenly a spirit appears, and the whole thing changes. There's a dance, or there's music, And that really interested me, that idea that rather than describe something, you just manifest it through a change of form.
Mm.
So that's really what that poem
is
doing.
I think it's striking, because one of the striking things about it is a form. It appears in this kind of theatre form. I know you're in the preface you're careful to say it's not a play, and it's obviously not a play. But it did bring to mind Beckett reading it, mainly in the concision of it, the sort of almost fierceness of the concision that reminded me of Beckett. But also it's got this kind of incredible Zen-like clarity, hasn't it? It's got incredible commitment to observation.
Mm.
I wonder whether you could just say something about you as an observer. That one of the things that I enjoy about the poems particularly is your wonderful capacity to see.
Yes, I suppose I'm a real believer in sort of learning from what's beyond yourself. So trying to find some way to record things in such a way that their own energy comes through rather than your energy. So I try to trick myself in lots of ways, and I did with that poem. I ended up, I mean, the poem does kind of, it has me in it as a character, as this dream secretary who's endlessly just kind of writing things down, because I endlessly seem to be biking to the Severn in pouring rain with a notebook that would be kind of absolutely washed out, sort of standing on bridges waiting for the tide to come in, and it was, I was just being mocked by what I was recording. and I was always there, sort of in an anorak with a sort of bicycle, lifting it over stiles, and so that kind of came into the poem, that idea that you try really hard and meticulously to record something, and then when it happens, it's completely different. And it's about the lack of control, really, that a poet has over the poem.
And is Beckett an influence in it, do you think?
Very much so, yeah.
It's even got the sort of mad humour of Beckett somewhere.
Yeah, I love Beckett, and I always get told that I'm in this kind of line with, you know, Hughes and Clare and all those people. But actually, there's something about Beckett. Again, I think he's really interested in light. I always think that Beckett is really writing about light. In his plays, what mostly happens is a light comes on or goes off. In Waiting for Godot, you've got the moon rises twice. And there are various plays where just lamps just kind of flick on and then flick off. And I'm just really interested in this idea of using language as a kind of pinhole through which light comes. I've been very interested in Beckett.
But then the mood changes very much in Weeds and Wild Flowers. Again, it seems to challenge what we think a poetry book would be. So one of the things I was feeling really reading is that each collection has got its own music, hasn't it? So Dart has got very much its own music. Sleepwalk on the Severn, even though apparently it looks like it could be a similar thing, it isn't, and has got its own music. And then Weeds and Wildflowers has got a very different music again, this time using Jessica Greenman's frankly enviable etchings, which are just gorgeous. Really, really lovely. And as you say, it's not that her etchings are illustrating the poems, they're sort of shuffled into the poems. Can you say something about the conversations you had with her and how the poems came out of that, and going back to gardening, perhaps, I don't know.
But. Yeah. She's incredibly different from me. She was an old friend of my husband's who used to come and stay, and she lived in London, you know, would never get up before about 12 or 1 or 2, never not be in high heels. I mean, I could go on. So there was this very funny juxtaposition with both of us that, you know, I was this kind of dowdy country bumpkin with three children getting up at sort of 6 in the morning or earlier. But we found that we both had mothers who were gardeners, and so we just started talking about plants more and more. And I just loved her way of thinking about them. She is a little bit, sort of, I don't think she'd mind me saying she's a little bit crazy. She actually believes she's the reincarnation of a violet. Of a violet.
Huh? We've all been there.
And she has this incredibly sort of animated, anthropomorphic sort of way of seeing flowers. And I found that funny and inspiring. And I suppose because we had such different lives, and I was very much bound up with childcare, it was hard to be as collaborative as we'd like to have been.
Mm.
We did a lot of ringing each other up and having incredibly long conversations about flowers.
Mm.
Sometimes I'd write a poem and send it to her and she'd send back a picture. Sometimes it'd be the other way around.
Mm.
But mostly it would be just little odd things that she'd say in a telephone conversation that would just really sort of set me going. I remember her talking about her delight in the kind of cruelty of making daisy chains. And that was, I just loved that, and I immediately put that into a poem. So, yeah, it was, and it, I'm a great believer in collaboration. Again, that goes back to my kind of fantasies about Homer, because I always think that actually a poem is better if it's written by more than one person. And very much that book is more than one person.
So let's move on to Memorial, talking about Homer. And again, very, very different music to the books that have gone before. Again, a book-length book. You call it an excavation of Homer, of the Iliad. Again, it seems to play with form. So you have this, first of all, it starts with a list of nearly 200 names, just a list which again reminds me of Ian Hamilton Finlay. Then you tell the biography of the death, some of them just a line, of many of those names and go through the names in the collection. It made me wonder whether, with your love of Homer and reading Homer as a teenager, whether you'd always wanted to write from the Iliad. You say you went from the Greek.
Mm.
Is that true? Was that something you were always sort of thinking
I was,
of doing?
In a way, for a long time, I was more of an Odyssey person. I think having children made me love the Iliad more because there's something about having children that you become quite morbid, I think. You're just so so aware of how fragile life is. But I was always really terrified of going near it because it's such a sacred poem to me. And I sort of had this idea that I would write a female version and that I would focus on Helen, who's the most fascinating character in it. And I sort of thought that was what I was setting out to do, and then as I explored the text, something completely different happened. So, yeah, I mean, it was kind of years and years of not quite daring to approach it, and then quite quickly I suddenly found a way in.
And you worked straight from the Greek, did you translate it from the Greek?
Yes, I worked from the Greek, and I was quite keen to sort of abandon translations, because I do think, I mean, of course, every translation has its own slant, and all the ones I knew seemed to have this kind of male nobility thing that I don't think you get in the Greek. And I wanted to remember the freshness, really, and the sort of energy of the Greek. And it was, it was quite a joy to go back to it.
And can you say something about what you call the bipolar nature of it? You've got these short biographies, and then you've got these almost biblical refrains that you repeat, the sort of similes that you repeat in an almost sort of biblical way, it seems. Could you say something about that?
So the poem divides into the biographies and the similes, and it takes out the central story of the Iliad, which is the story of Achilles. And I'm a sort of great believer in Heraclitus. I like things being opposed to each other. I like contradiction. I don't like to resolve something. For me, there's something very pleasing when a form sort of holds two things in friction against each other. And the way that creates a kind of gap between them. And, again, that kind of thing that happens between words rather than in the words interests me. And, of course, Homer, because he was an oral poet, used repetition a lot. He used these kind of Homeric formulae, they're called, where he has a kind of stock phrase that he will slot into the poem whenever Achilles is mentioned or whenever some character is mentioned. And I didn't want to do exactly that because I thought it would be artificial because I'm not an oral poet. But I needed a gesture towards repetition. And I'm very interested in, I suppose Beckett's quite interested in repetition as well. I'm really interested in things happening the same, and yet they're not the same when they happen twice. I love that fact. And that was another thing that really irritated people, the fact that even on the page, you just have a block of text that is then repeated exactly.
Mm.
And a lot of people say, well, I don't want to read it twice, but I like the fact that the very least that does is it says this poem is a sound, not just a text. Because if you have something printed twice, you know that verbally, orally, that has to be spoken twice. Mm. But more than that, it gives what you get in Homer is this, there's something very, it's a poem that keeps kind of stopping. It doesn't just flow forwards, it has this amazing kind of hesitation within it. And I didn't want to write something that just flows like a novel from beginning to end. I wanted it to kind of have a counterflow backwards.
It's striking that repetition, because at first you sort of think, oh, good heavens, it's the same. Mm. It's exactly the same. And yet as you read it, and especially when I read it again, it changes again, doesn't it, when you read it again?
Yeah, and I think above all, when you're hearing it, I think people do say it really works when you hear it out loud.
So let's just finally, I want to talk to you a bit more about the spiritual nature of your work. For me, your poems, personally speaking, I think some of the most spiritual poems I've read, contemporary poetry I've read, don't always know what I mean by that. It's one of those words, isn't it, people bandy about, especially in circles like this. It's not unreadable, you know what I mean. But the one thing I think I mean about it in your case is this, I think, Zen-like concentration and observation, this empathy with nature, not standing back and sort of analysing it, but empathising, which feels very Zen-like in some ways. But also this sense that the world means more than you can say seems to pervade all the poems, in all the way from the Weeds and Wildflowers all the way to the Dot. Have you got thoughts about the spiritual content of your poetry? It's probably not something you think consciously about it, but
it's incredibly hard to talk about all this, isn't it?
Yes,
I suppose I do start from the premise that that at least the human is infinite, and that means that I kind of look for that human aspect in everything, which means the infinite aspect in everything. And I think that's why I'm interested in, sorry to repeat myself, but in the pinhole, because rather than trying to kind of explain something myself, I feel that if I can have a kind of a hole in the centre of anything I write, then whatever is more than me can at least get through into it. So it's almost a kind of a technical thing for me that because I think there is something more than myself, and if I leave space for it, I trust that it'll get into the poem. It's sort of as basic as that, really.
Is it a sort of standing, allowing it to happen, you think?
Yeah, I know that if I started to try and explain something or describe something, I'd get it wrong and I'd limit it. So it's really a question of actually crafting a hole. Literally, I try and make a hole or an eye pupil in every poem through which something that's more than me can get in.
Is that in the silence around it as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think very much in the way that you can do that through sound. You can make the sound such that it will actually suggest silence. I think a poem has to try and include more than itself. To me, that's what binds it into a poem, rather than being a sort of collection of phrases or whatever. It has to invoke some kind of sense of gravity or something that will then give it a coherence.
And finally, I always ask our guests this, but what would you say poetry is for? You committed yourself to poetry when you were 8, from that night of not being able to sleep or whatever. Very striking thing that you did there. In your own life, what is it for? What does it do for us? You say that you're human and infinite, and I agree, obviously, I agree. What is poetry for in that infinite? To evoke it?
Yeah, it's very difficult to know, isn't it? I mean, for me, it does seem to be the way that I can keep the infinite in my life on a sort of day-to-day basis. So it's a way of invoking more than myself, not just for the making of a poem, but actually for the leading of my life. I do find I need that. But it's really hard to say what poetry's for. I've been trying to think of it for years now, and I think as soon as you think it's something, it vanishes and it becomes something else.
That's probably it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.